Listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. The International Airlines Organisation says the fire that led to the closure of Heathrow raises serious questions about how the London airport is run. IATA said an internationally important piece of infrastructure should not be dependent on a single power source. Power to the airport, one of the world's busiest, was cut by a big fire at an electricity substation. The blaze disrupted the travel plans of more than 200,000 passengers. Jonathan Smith speaks for the London Fire Brigade.
This is one of those types of fire that burns for a significant period of time. What we have to do is cool that down, and it's the nature of the cooling agent or the oil that was on fire, and that takes time to bring that under control. However, we are confident that we can work with our partners to restore power as soon as possible. As we stand at the moment, the fire is under control, the air quality is good, and we don't anticipate any further safety issues for members of the public.
It's been announced that counter-terror police will lead inquiries into the substation fire. A police statement said there was currently no sign of foul play. Our Home Affairs correspondent is Daniel Sanford.
It's probably an accident, but clearly there are concerns that would somebody want to shut down that bit of our national infrastructure, whether that would be a hostile state or a terrorist group. So clearly part of the investigation is that counter-terrorism police are going to be involved. Now, my understanding is that's not because there's some evidence being found of sabotage, that there's some direct evidence which points to sabotage, but more that they've got a particular set of skills which means that they should be involved at an early stage to see if there was any kind of device or anything that caused this fire.
Sudan's army says it's recaptured the presidential palace in Khartoum from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The RSF had controlled the building and large parts of the capital since the civil war began nearly 2 years ago. Videos on social media showed army soldiers celebrating inside the damaged palace. Israel's defence minister has threatened to permanently occupy parts of Gaza if Hamas refuses to release its remaining hostages. Yisrael Katz said he'd ordered the army to capture additional territory in Gaza. Yoland Nell is in Jerusalem.
The Israeli defence minister says Palestinians could be ordered to move from the north to the south of the territory once again. Hamas, meanwhile, has stated that it remains deeply involved in ceasefire and hostage release talks and is considering different ideas put forward, including one from the US, with the goal of ending the war. A UN official has warned it's now the longest period since the start of the war in 2023 that no supplies have been allowed into Gaza, and says this is reversing progress made during the ceasefire.
As the Israeli offensive continues, the medical charity MSF said one of its staff had been killed in an Israeli airstrike. World News from the BBC.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and the Wine and Hop Shop, located at 1919 Monroe Street, specializing in homebrewing and winemaking supplies for over 40 years. Open to in-person shopping or order online for curbside pickup, in-Madison delivery and shipping of supplies at wineandhop.com.
Thank you. Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. It's March 21. I'm Andy Moore. We've got a packed show this hour, even though our first guests aren't here. It's live radio. We're not going to panic, Jim. Everything's under control. Engineer Without Peer, Jim Wilson, has a nice, cool look on his face, having pedaled in. And I drove in, so I saw Jim pass me on the bike path. Then I passed him in my car. Then Jim passed me on the bike path. Then I passed him in my car. I was using the fossil fuel. Like I said, we've got a packed show, so I got to get directly into this week's rant. Earlier this week, this is the truth, I overheard a cranky guy in a restaurant talking about how he hates government regulations. So you know that guy. And the whole gripe about how government is too big. And then he said something. It sounded like an old saying, but I'd never heard it. He said, "Fortunately, you don't get as much government as you pay for." So there you have it in a nutshell. Government bad. Of course, now the court system is bad too. And poor people and immigrants and trans and gay people are bad. And veterans are bad. And public school teachers and university employees are bad. And on and on. But that government line I overheard that guy say, the one I just said, "Fortunately, you don't get as much government as you pay for." It summarizes just how satisfied MAGA supporters are that Musk and Trump are vaporizing entire departments, the Department of Education, of course, being this week's example. But here's the thing. As much as eliminating ways to make Head Start work and laying off veterans and arresting university professors and dehumanizing trans people, as much as those things make my blood boil and my heart break for our country, I realized this week that arguing with a Trump supporter about any of those actions will only make that supporter more MAGA supportive, not less so. So, last Friday, Trump handed us, at least in my mind, a clear-cut example of his unfitness that could actually make sense if pointed out to a MAGA person, as long as you didn't put them on the defensive first. You can't do it that way. Nobody likes to be on the defensive. So last Friday, right after I got off the air and I bumped into this, in his comments to members of the Justice Department, he talked for 5 minutes and 13 seconds about the late Indiana University basketball coach Bobby Knight. And that soundbite sounded a little like this. He talked about Bobby Knight.
Came up and said, "Do you know Bobby Knight?" I said, "No, I don't, but I hear he was a tough cookie." He said, "Not only tough, he was beyond tough, but he's the most popular guy you can imagine." It turned out
5 minutes and 13 seconds about a basketball coach. It wasn't an aside. An aside is 13 seconds. This was, did I tell you? 5 minutes and 13 seconds.
Turned out he wanted to endorse me, called me. About 2 years before, he said, "Sir, I'd like to endorse you." I said, "Is this really Bobby Knight?" I said, "It's me." I could tell it was Bobby Knight.
This is the President of the United States, people, talking with high-ranking Justice Department officials, all very, very busy people. And the President took 5 minutes of these people's lives away from them forever. They'll never get those minutes back. Talking about what? Talking about the late Bobby Knight. Never mind that Trump was praising a guy, Bobby Knight, who choked one of his players with his own hands and threw a folding chair out onto the court because he didn't like a call. Never mind that.
He had been known for throwing the chair across the court and slapping a player. Can't do things like that, right? And the man that came in fired him. He was a new administrator.
Yeah. No, President Trump, you can't do things like that. That's why Bobby Knight was fired. But Trump is obsessed with Bobby Knight. Hey, folks, never mind Bobby Knight did those reprehensible things. It would be deranged if a president talked in the middle of a presentation to the Justice Department officials for 5 minutes about a basketball coach who was a good guy. As it is, it would be strange if Trump spent 15 minutes at the dinner table talking about a dead coach who was a jerk. But at least it would be on his own time. You know, times have changed. If George W. Bush went into Iran about a dead basketball coach for 5 minutes while addressing the Justice Department, the Secret Service would have come after him with a sedative. Or imagine if Biden all of a sudden lurched into a 15-minute bit about a dead basketball coach while talking to the Justice Department. They would have put him on a gurney. So I asked Trump supporters, and there's got to be at least one that listens to this program, and I asked this sincerely. Do you want a president Do you want someone running this country that talks about Bobby Knight for 15 minutes while on the clock during a busy day filled with domestic and global problems to fix? I'm just asking, you know. Never mind if we disagree on what the problems are. Just consider my question about a president spending 15 minutes and 13 seconds of God-fearing, precious American time talking about Bobby Knight. Don't answer right away. Sleep on it. That's because we've got a show to do, and we've got to move it along. It's packed. Live music later this morning with members of Shaky, who will take their Neil Young tribute show to the opera, Stoughton Opera House next weekend. And we'll hear about a screenwriter symposium that will take place adjacent to the upcoming Wisconsin Film Festival. These troubled times, such as we were just describing, are on all of us. And later we'll hear from a member of one of the world's oldest continuously running Alcoholics Anonymous chapters about help for addicts. And we'll also hear about a town hall meeting. This is the guests who are still not here. and guess what the topic is? Not showing up for, Republicans not showing up for town halls. And we're hoping that the guests who are going to talk about people not showing up for the town hall will show up. I'm sure that they will. Encore's live music picks, a Bobby Knight career retrospective, kidding about that. Music provided by Friday Buzz music director Encore Malhotra. Engineer without peer Jim Wilson is why we're actually on the airwaves. Thanks for the playback on the Trump Bites, Jim. Online producer Elliot LeBrun is busy painting the front office. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Suddenly, Greg Gard is looking pretty good. Let's get buzzing. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Segment 2. As we were discussing in the open, these are stressful times, no matter your politics. And you don't have to be a drug counselor to know that stress can increase a person's desire to self-medicate, either with alcohol, drugs, other substances, behaviors. Wisconsin wears her binge drinking like a badge of honor. And that culture doesn't help things. The cultural acceptance here also probably helps explain why Wisconsin ranked nearly every year as the drunkest state in the country. In fact, the Wall Street Journal identified in 2022, for example, that based on self-reporting, 25.2% of Wisconsin residents drink excessively. Wisconsin is also known as the home of one of, if not the oldest, chapter of continuously running Alcoholic Anonymous in the world. The 511 Alano Society in Madison has been hosting AA gatherings since 1948. That's 77 years. We thought, given these stressful times, that it was a good time to check in with the ways and means of AA, and here to help us with that is Phil Saunders of 511. Good morning, Phil, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here again.
Good. 77 years. That's a lot of meetings. For those in the dark about what happens at an AA meeting, take us inside one. What happens?
Well, first off, let me correct you. We've been at 511 North Carroll Street, right downtown,
yes,
for 77 years, but we started on the square in 43. So okay. We're actually celebrating our 82nd anniversary this
Congratulations.
Year. Congratulations. OMG, as the young people say.
Yeah.
And the basic premise is to share our experience, strength, and hope.
Experience, strength, and hope. Those three tie together in somewhat of an organic way.
Very much so.
What is the importance and the significance of being anonymous in an AA meeting?
There is, believe it or not, in 2025, still an incredible stigma about alcoholism, drug addiction, sex addiction, gambling addiction, overeaters, mental health in general. You know, it's all right to have cancer. It's all right to have diabetes, but God forbid you should have emotional problems.
Yes. And so anonymity gives people the assurance that those stigmas are going to stay away for the purpose of the mission of getting better and getting sober.
We usually conclude our meetings with someone saying, remember who you see here, what you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here. And then the whole room goes, you're here.
It is a community experience.
Absolutely.
But let's stay with the stigma for a second. And this takes us out of the meeting. I just wanted to pick your brain on that piece of it. What can you think of for us as a society, as a culture, to get past these stigmas? What can happen that can put those aside?
Well, Betty Ford, I think, was enormous in that she came out as a recovering alcoholic during her time in the White House, literally. And as a friend of mine said in the 90s, I'm so glad that the 80s are over and alcoholism isn't fashionable anymore.
Huh. And that's fascinating. And that's a great example. And Betty Ford helped that come about.
Indeed.
Everyone comes to an AA meeting, I perceive, for their own reason. But what do you think, Phil, generally speaking, is an important reason, one that would aid in someone's success in the program?
I could not say that there is a single important reason. I can say, without fear of contradiction, no one ever wanted to go to AA. They were forced into going to AA by their family, by their employer, by the courts, and we have had thousands and thousands of people come in for a day or a week or a month or 90 days and fulfill whatever obligation they had agreed to with whomever forced them there. And then disappeared. So our attrition rate is frightening.
Is that right? And what about retention?
Again, frightening. There are so many so-called new solutions now, and they're actually old things that date back to the 19th century. AA is actually the new kid on the block as far as its approach to alcoholism, which began in 1935 with a guy named Bill Wilson and another guy called Dr. Bob, and they are considered the founders. And as Bill Wilson said famously in one of his interviews, the floundering fathers, because they had no idea what they were doing. They stole a lot from the Oxford group, which was religious-based. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, AA works very hard to not be religious based. It is a spiritual program, which can be described in my perspective as we all in it together. Yeah. Everybody that needs to be in those meetings, everybody that is in those meetings, and everybody that thinks we're a bunch of cultists because we are in those meetings, we all in it together.
It reminds me of that bumper sticker, everyone does better when everyone does better.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Phil Saunders. He's with the Madison AA Clubhouse, known as the 511 Alano Society, one of the oldest continuously running clubhouses in the world. Speaking of the physical location, which you did on Mansion Hill here in Madison, it's actually a historic designation, isn't it?
It is. We actually have a plaque in our front yard, and we got that designation from the city, I'm not sure, but roughly a dozen years ago.
Yeah. People in AA that I've known talk a lot about, quote-unquote, the work, and there's a lot of it, it seems. The steps, attendance, sponsor relationships, so forth. It can become, it seems, almost like a second family commitment for some people. What do you tell folks who are interested in joining AA, but who may be intimidated by what seems like almost like a half-time job?
It is the toughest job you will ever have. It is, however, also the very best paying.
Your life is returned.
Absolutely.
And you can't put a price on that.
Not only life, but quality of life.
Yeah.
We have something called the promises, in which we talk about how good things can get when you work the steps and find peace.
Mm. What have you seen that can account for how stress contributes to excessive drinking?
It is even worse now. I am terrified for young people because of the impact of social media and bullying on social media. But it's also very true in the workplace, especially in larger corporations where there are fiefdoms and cliques and whatnot. And then there's the court system where people without money are arrested for all sorts of things. The situation in the world today, which as a Vietnam era veteran, not actual veteran, we thought that was tough, but there was nothing like this.
Yeah, yeah. There are people listening this morning, you and I both know, that could use the experience of AA. Fear plays a great deal, a great part in anyone's personal desire to change, no matter what they're trying to change. Speak to those people in that fear that are maybe trying to get off the starting line and maybe try and come to a meeting.
Fear is at the core of everything. And if you look for the most reprehensible person in the world that you loathe, there's some fear going on there. We're not quite sure what it might be in some cases because they seem to have all the power and all the money, but they're afraid of something. And we talk about rigorous honesty. And rigorous honesty is not telling your drunk a log, and this was the time I ran from the cops, and that was the time I jumped off the building. It's about, I am terrified by where my life is. I am deeply ashamed of where my life is. I am incredibly lonely because I don't feel like anyone understands me or knows who I am.
Yeah.
And I am unable to talk about these things because it's not done. I receive entirely too many publications, and there have been a couple of dozen articles in the past year alone about the epidemic of loneliness in this country, and I'm sure in the world. And a big part of that is people lack community. One of my favorite lines is, social media isn't.
Oh.
It isn't social.
Yes.
And what all programs give, and of course at 511, we open our doors to anyone in any sort of 12-step program.
Yes.
So again, alcoholics, mm-hmm. narcotics, mm-hmm. gambling,
yes.
Al-Anon,
yes.
which is family members.
Yes.
Sex addicts, overeaters, whoever would like. And I was so excited that yesterday I got a call from Briar Patch, whom I had called probably 6 weeks ago. And
yeah.
it turned out that the person that I had called was in Europe for a month.
Okay,
oh, well.
There you go. Whoops.
But she did call back.
Great.
And my thinking was that if people are involved with Briar Patch, there's a good chance there's some alcohol running around in that family situation
yes.
somewhere.
Yes.
So maybe we could be of service to them.
That sounds like a good example.
By providing a meeting space
yes.
for them to get together and deal with some of these issues.
Yes. In the scarce seconds that we have left, this tough question to ask you to answer in a short way, but I'm going to. What would the world be like without AA?
Well, it would not exist for me. I had a broken hip a couple of years back, and because of modern medicine, it was resolved quickly and wonderfully. I still walk the golf course. And I was musing with a friend of mine. I said, you know, if this had happened 100 years ago, I'd have been crippled for life. And he said, no, Phil, if you lived 100 years ago, you'd have died drunk in your 20s.
Okay. Phil Saunders, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz. I hope you have a great weekend.
You know I will.
Thank you. Phil Saunders is with Madison AA Clubhouse, known as 511 Alano Society, one of the oldest continuously running clubhouses in the world. All right. This hour keeps rolling. It's already going fast. We're hoping to talk with one or two of the organizers of the Where's Rojo Town Hall this morning. If they're on the premises, I think they may be. So we'll be coming up with that after some music and Encore's picks. And you're listening to WRTFM.org online, WRTFM 89.9 on the radio, originating from Bedford Street in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:26.
Buffet parties, dinner parties, cocktail parties, etc., etc., etc.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and TNW Ensemble Theater, presenting Scammed, a new comedy running March 13th through March 23rd at TNW Ensemble Theater, 1957 Winnebago Street. When a freelancing editor falls for a classic scam, she assumes the amoral alter ego of Helen Wheels to get even. Tickets are available at the door with cash or check, or online through Ticket Tailor. More information is available by calling 608-770-0826.
When we reached out to our volunteers and to you, our listeners, and asked for your help during the recently concluded Winter Pledge Drive, you responded. Thank you.
If you got a problem, don't care what it is. If you need a hand, I can assure you this.
Because of you, we reached our goal for the drive, including matching every dollar of the challenge grant, welcoming 143 new donors, and welcoming back many more. Now, it's our turn to focus on playing the music you love, the news you need, and the civil discussions that make sense of the issues. It's our turn to help.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. You haven't really made any picks other than your brackets, but there's lots of live music to choose from this weekend between basketball games. And now we're going to get Encore's picks. But first, here's Jim Wilson with Encore's picks disclaimer.
Encore's picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Encore consults with an advisory board of one, Encore Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Encore, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Encore has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Encore's picks: for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Encore's picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed.
Aaron,
here's Encore Malhotra.
Good morning. Morning, Madison. It's spring. You know, sure feels like it. Not. But you could get warmed up at the Old Brick Gardens at the Conservancy. March 21st today, DJ Gemini Killy. I hope it's Killy or Jilly. Gemini Jilly. That's tonight. And in case you plan to head to Stoughton Opera House tomorrow for Marty Stewart and the Fabulous Superlatives, both those shows, seems like the two shows, but it's a sold-out concert, so instead, you could head over for a beautiful noise. That's the Neil Diamond musical going on this week at the Overture Center. So that's on today through the weekend, and I think, yeah. And then later in the week, special DJ Evan Woodward. You might know him from Strictly Dis, but he's going to be spinning at Momoca. That's the Museum of Contemporary Art, March 27th. Much of that happening, and of course, I'll be on the decks tomorrow, 2 p.m., for the Pan-Africa radio show. All that here with Spin Cycle.
Thank you, Encore. DJ Spin Cycle on the decks tomorrow on WRT. It's the Friday O'Clock Buzz. I'm Andy Moore. A couple months into the Trump administration, Republican representatives began doing something you wouldn't think would make a lot of news. They began to meet with their constituents, you know, back, you know, in the district, as they say. So what's the big deal about that? Well, some of those town halls turned into the closing scene in the Shirley Jackson novel, The Lottery. Did you read that, Cameron? You ever read that book?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, suffice it to say that it ends with a lot of rocks being thrown. It turns out Republicans got an earful from constituents confused by the Trump agenda, an agenda that many of them voted for. Republican leadership quickly sent down word to members to stop their town halls. But that won't stop one that happens in Madison tonight. Where's Rojo, short for U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, takes place at 7 o'clock at the First Congregational Church on University Avenue. It's organized by pro-democracy organization Indivisible. Cameron Lane Flehinger is with Indivisible and joins us now. Cameron, welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Did I stomp all over your last name?
No, that's better than most people do.
Oh, misery loves company. Will you say it?
Cameron Lane Flehinger.
Flehinger. Okay. Thank you. Indivisible. What's the mission and work there?
The mission and the work is to rebuild our democracy and to stop the Trump-Musk takeover of our federal government. And that's based on an understanding that what's happening in Washington right now is severe. It's the most serious, unprecedented crisis we've faced since at least the Civil War in this country. And yet it's merely the symptom of a democracy that's been diminished and ailing for a long time.
Indivisible on their main website offers, quote, a practical guide to resist the Trump agenda. Different words, but somewhat of the sentiment you just described. I know tonight's event is an example of an action that would be included in a guide like that. What are other examples of resistant actions for people who are interested in Indivisible's work, but also in taking action on their own?
Yeah, so one of the great things about Indivisible is that we, as local chapters, are allowed to be very broad in our organizing. So we're encouraging people to go to a wide variety of actions. We're supportive of the Tesla takedown events that are happening over on the West Side on Fridays and Saturdays right now. We held our own rally to defend democracy on March 9th, and we'll be holding more things like that in the future. And then it's even just basic community events like local sign making to support Susan Crawford, where people come together in a friendly space. They talk about politics a little bit, and they build community. And that's politics. Politics isn't something that filters all the way down from the top levels. It's something you do with people in your community. That's how it has to work in a democratic society.
Forgive me if this sounds like I'm playing with words. I assure you I'm not. The word resistance is used a lot. It always has been in this context. How does resistance lead to change?
By taking action. The thing that is becoming crystal clear to me is that nothing happens on its own. It's true of the bad guys in Washington. It's remarkable. We're finding out how much just, you know, 10 to 12, 20-year-olds who are empowered can do if they just walk into an office and declare themselves in charge. And we can take that same attitude and say that if we do things, we will stop things from happening. They can't do anything automatically. And so everything we make it harder for them to do happens less.
What will happen tonight at the town hall? What will the format be?
Constituents will get 1 to 2 minutes to go up and deliver a message to their senior senator that he's unwilling to hear. And people, I believe, will be supportive of those messages. They'll get a lot of energy from seeing that there are many people out there like them who are not okay with what's going on. And Ron Johnson has done a great job of insulating himself from the feedback of his constituents, even including the fact that his Madison office is all the way out by the highway. And we're just going to make it shown to people that we're not okay with what's happening, and we're not okay with him calling people who push back on his rubber stamping of the Trump-Musk agenda paid troublemakers. They're not. These are real constituents, and they're going to be in the same place, and they're going to support each other.
As I prepared and considered your and my conversation this morning, the cynic in me couldn't help but think about Senator Johnson more or less conceding this part of the state anyway, and that a gathering like this might not put a dent in the bucket. However, hearing what you just said turned that around for me, because it matters if one's beliefs are shared with others' beliefs. And am I getting the gospel of this now with regard to what will happen tonight?
There's that. I think it's also, this is a moment to be really earnest in our civic beliefs. The Constitution guarantees all of us two senators, whether we vote for Democrats or Republicans or anybody else. That is a really fundamental part of our democracy. And yeah, I've encountered this sentiment before. I was just looking at an op-ed that appeared, I think, in the Journal Sentinel the last time that Indivisible did this in 2017, and they called it an ambush. And frankly, I think that's kind of ridiculous. A senator ambushed in public by his constituents? How is that possible?
Yeah, yeah. Cameron Lane-Flettinger, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz, and good luck with the event tonight.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. Cameron Lane-Flettinger is with the pro-democracy group Indivisible. They're hosting a town hall meeting tonight, as we've been speaking to, that calls attention to Republicans dialing down constituent encounters. It's called Where's Rojo, short for Wisconsin, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. It's at the First Congregational Church on University Avenue with a 7 o'clock start, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Good deal. Okay, we have a lot more ahead, including live music from Neil Young practitioners, members of Shaky. And we're going to talk with some screenwriters about a forthcoming screenwriter symposium held adjacent to the Wisconsin Film Festival. That's next. You're listening to WRT FM 89.9 Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:37. At 8 o'clock Buzz, I'm Andy Moore. A lot is being made about the forthcoming Wisconsin Film Festival, but what's a film without a screenplay, right? Enter the UW-Madison Department of Communication Arts. The department is hosting a screenwriter symposium on campus the weekend of Friday, April 4th. The symposium isn't just for aspiring screenwriters. It's for storytellers of all kinds. and even just lovers of good cinema. Two of the organizers are with us. Good morning and welcome to Commerce Associate Professor Aaron Greer and screenwriter and producer and UW alum Rebecca Williams-Spindler. Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning. Thanks good morning. For having us.
Also with us, another UW alum on the phone in Chicago. That's where film director, actor, and screenwriter John Mossman lives. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Andy.
Regular listeners will recognize John's voice. I just have to make this disclaimer. Disclaimer the right word, John? It sounds like I'm dismissing you.
Yeah, sure. But, you're legally not responsible.
John, I think this is your first appearance on this show as John Mossman. If you listen to that cackle and that voice, John has appeared on this program a dozen times. As characters in fake interviews. But this is a real interview, isn't it, John?
You tell me, Andy.
It's a real interview. I'm going to give you a real question.
Okay.
What are the ingredients to a good screenplay, John?
Oh, God. Boy, I personally like a beginning, middle, and an end, and a dramatic question. Just those things that kind of keep it moving along and make it feel... complete. I like those. I also think something, if it contains the voice of the filmmaker, ultimately, I consider that good. I'm more of a, I'm a filmmaker, so I don't probably focus as much on writing something that you're going to sell to somebody.
Rebecca, I read a quote, I forget who said it, and I hope I can get it even a fraction of it right, but something about, who was it? A very good actor said, it's not the actor's job to be funny, it's the writer's job.
Yeah.
What's going on with a quote like that?
Well, I agree with that, because the essence of what the actor's trying to portray was written on the page, right? And so what we're trying to do here with the symposium is introduce folks that are either just getting started with interest in screenwriting, or people who are seasoned and they want to connect with folks that are in the industry. We're going to have some amazing industry professionals coming in from LA and all over to talk to folks about what it's like to be a screenwriter in today's world. John Mossman's going to be part of a panel talking about how to write on a budget. Mm-hmm. So for folks that want to run around with their iPhone and do their short in a weekend, come and learn how to do that. And if you want to learn how to make a compelling character, come and learn about what it takes to write a character that absorbs the actor, right?
Yes.
That leaps off the page and leaps off the screen. Don't you agree, Aaron?
Absolutely, yeah.
Rebecca, I'm compelled to ask you as a screenwriter the same question I asked John, though, briefly. What are the ingredients in your mind to a good screenplay? Let's say the difference between a good one and a great one.
For me, a good movie is one that you talk about for days afterwards, right? Or one that makes you laugh and makes you cry, or one that makes you maybe reconsider an opinion that you had on life.
That's cool. It leads me to a question for Aaron. When people think about and talk about movies, and I'm talking about people not in the industry, movie lovers, movie goers, they'll generally grab onto the substance that actors bring to a project. Sometimes they'll talk about directors or direction, even if they don't know they're talking about direction. Not a lot of talking goes into, the page 7 of that, not a lot of talk goes into the importance of screenplay. So this is a convoluted way of asking you, Aaron, to help us focus on the source of it all, the importance of the screenplay. Could you name one that stands out as excellent in your mind, a specific one from a film people might know, and tell us why you think it worked?
Oh, wow. One good screenplay. a screenplay I like to teach a lot is, this is a little dated now for some folks, but Brokeback Mountain.
Right? Okay.
It's really a beautifully written screenplay adapted from a beautifully written short story.
Yes.
And part of the reason I like to teach that is the short story works on its own wonderfully, right? Award-winning short story. But it's, 15 pages, right? It's a quick read. And that gets turned into this beautiful, 2.5 hour movie. And the act of translation there to make something that is a piece of literary text that works to something that is meant to work on the screen, right? Not to be good screenplays are fun to read and they're a quick read, but they're not meant as literature. They're meant to be something that are translated to the screen. And so the way that it evokes the images, the emotion, the characters, and then, yeah, when we watch these movies, right, we think about the notable quotables, the Luke, I'm your father, and the you know make my day, and all these kind of
That's
lines.
Right,
but
yeah.
Somebody came up with those lines.
They sure
right?
did. And, yeah. And indelible ink. Hey, John Mossman, what a screenplay that you can think of from a film that you, most people know, that you think really clicked?
Oh, the first screenplay that I read that really made me want to write because it just spoke in his voice and it was vivid was Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. The way that that's written for me was so personal and vibrant and kind of a little bit rule breaking from what I'd seen. So for me, that was one that I distinctly remember.
John Mossman, Aaron Greer, Rebecca Williams-Spindler are organizers and presenters of the upcoming UW-Madison Commerce Department Screenwriters Symposium. That's on tap for the weekend of April 4. For more info, go to screenwriters.comarts.wisc.edu. Comarts with two M's, comarts.wisc.edu. Rebecca, a screenplay is more than exposition, so many people have never laid eyes on one. The format calls for all kinds of instruction and description. Talk about what's on a given page that a writer gives to a film when they're preparing a script, when they're writing a what does the screenplay page look like? What does it include?
Well, you've got brief description and dialogue, but you want to stay away from direction because that's the director's job. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to tell on the page, well, the camera looks at this or the camera looks at that. You want to tell, like I said, the essence of the story. Like, what motivated you to write the story in the first place? Well, hopefully it comes through in the pages. So everyone has an inspiration one way or another. And if you have the gumption to actually take the time and type it out or write it out, good for you.
Right? Some of what Rebecca just said, John Mossman, brings us back to one of your secret ingredients that you spoke to at the top of our conversation, and that is raise a question. Think out loud a little bit more about that. That's kind of an interesting little morsel.
Well, it'd be like the thing that keeps people leaning forward, wondering what's going to happen, you know? And it's always just a good reminder for me when I teach my young filmmakers in the process of expressing themselves or making something that maybe is personal or maybe just derivative, that there is the desire to engage an audience. You want an audience to be leaning forward, wondering what's going to happen. So for me, that sometimes gets forgotten. Every scene's a thriller, you know?
Yeah.
Can be.
John, speaking of young filmmakers, what's a common mistake a just starting out screenwriter makes?
Starting out with a feature and not a short, I think.
As a filmmaker,
yeah, starting out with a feature and not a short.
Okay.
You make your mistakes, you learn a lot about yourself and the team that you might or might not want to work with.
And
you learn a lot of good lessons on a short. And again, if the short has a beginning, middle, end, it's good. It's great.
Cool. I love the simplicity of that. Aaron, finally, in just like the 30 seconds or so we have left, what will happen on the weekend of April 4?
Oh, wow. What won't happen? Well, we've got like a dozen panels and presentations by industry experts and professionals, as Rebecca said, some local, some coming in from out of town. We've got panels on how to get into the industry, panels on writing the short film that John just talked about, panels on pitching. Panels on what am I missing here, Rebecca?
Working with budget.
Working on a budget.
Oh, sure.
So, and then networking events. We are also honoring, we had a screenplay competition. We're honoring the winner of that competition will have their script read by actors in a kind of table read performance on Sunday. Yeah. So a lot of great fun events, a lot of great presenters, and a lot of great screenwriters will be in attendance.
And I love that it's an application of what happens in movie making that's parallel to all of the eyes that will be watching the screens during the film festival too. Aaron Greer, Rebecca Williams-Spindler, and John Mossman in Chicago, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz, and good luck with the symposium.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I love that word symposium. I'm going to say it again. The UW-Madison ComArts Screenwriters Symposium, that just tastes so good. It takes place on campus the weekend of April 4, as we just said. For more information, go to screenwriters.comarts.wisc.edu. www.wic.edu. Symposium. Okay, hey, security is lacking here at WRT on Bedford Street, and I'm a little concerned. I know that because some musicians have been allowed to come into the building. They're members of Shaky, and we're going to talk all things Neil Young coming up next. This is WRT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:49. It's a Friday 8 o'clock buzz. That's a nice pre-420 pick there, too, Unker. Thank you very much. I always say I'm happy to see live musicians in the studio because they never complain about the coffee. That's because it's free. It's Shaky is rock musician Neil Young's longtime nickname. It's also the name of, in my opinion, the best biography of Young. And it's also the name of, in my opinion, the best Neil Young tribute band in Madison, and there are a lot of them. There's like 7 or 8 Neil Young tribute bands in Madison, but Shaky is the best, and they play the Stoughton Opera House a week from tomorrow, March 29. We have 3 members of the band here now, Maggie Weiser, Matt Appleby, and Tim Sullivan. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And I don't even see you drinking coffee, but oh well, anyway.
I finished mine already. Oh, very efficient.
You are efficient. Matt, I always thought that the nickname Shaky came from how Neil Young's voice sort of quakes and quivers. Is that where it came from?
I always thought it came from his epileptic seizures he used to have.
Oh, so what? A physical manifestation.
Yeah, back in the 60s and into the 70s, I think he finally got it under control.
Well, then people who have followed his life and his career in that order have come to understand a lot of health setbacks through the years with all manner of surgeries, and I hadn't really thought about that in the context of where his music's coming from too. In a way, his lived experience informs his music. Is that fair to say, Maggie?
Yeah, I guess I didn't think about it that way, but yeah, I mean, he's a very highly prolific songwriter, which is something that I always appreciate, which kind of, you know, brings about lots of different kinds of songs and styles and moods. And
well, I identified him as a rock and roll musician. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of music would you throw into the Neil Young bucket?
He's very, you know, folky. He's very folky, but
country, a lot of country.
Grunge,
pop, grunge. Godfather of grunge, right?
Yeah, that's right. He was grunge before grunge was a thing.
Cinnamon Girls, kind of like the first grunge song ever recorded.
Tim Sullivan, what was it about Neil Young music going way back that first attracted you?
Oh, I mean, I've been listening to Neil since I was a little kid. My older brothers were big Neil Young fans, so The record Decade was like on the turntable constantly, and I listened to that. And it was a great way to learn to play guitar. You know, that's how I learned to play. I was playing along to Neil Young songs.
You know, I think a lot of people first try out a six string might have been a Neil Young song.
Yeah.
It led me to play around with playing the harp too.
Yep.
With the guitar, it's kind of a slippery slope that way. What was your first experience with Neil Young, Matt?
I had a friend in college who was a big Neil fan, and he turned me on to Neil. I had always heard of him, but I never listened to his stuff. But
you know, it's like, this is a clumsy comparison, Maggie, but you hear Willie Nelson sing one word, and you know it's Willie Nelson. You hear Neil Young sing one word, and you know it's Neil Young.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, Neil Young is a better guitar player than Willie Nelson.
But yeah, no, Willie's pretty good.
I know, he is pretty good. We'll call it a tie. You guys are generous to come in with a song. So, folks, I'm going to shut up because we're going to hear a Neil Young song. Maggie, what are we going to hear? And then why don't you all play it?
Yeah, so one of the things I like the most about being in this band is that we all kind of take turns, like, singing leads, and so, you know, we switch off all the time, and so it gives everybody a chance to kind of express themselves through Neil's music in their own way and choose songs. Today, I'm going to sing a song called Sail Away.
All right, thanks. Let's hear it.
I could live inside the TV. I could die in penthouse 35. You could lose me on the freeway, but I would still make it back alive. As long as we can sail away, as long as we can sail.
Pretty. That was a perfect pick for the radio in the morning. Maggie Weiser singing lead on that. Tim Sullivan and Matt Appleby of Shaky. I can attest to this band's vocal prowess, and I love what Maggie described before she started singing about everyone in this band is a good singer. There aren't many bands that can say that. So it's kind of dramatic for the audience to watch Shaky mix it up on the vocals. It's a blast. And if you think you've heard all of Neil Young's catalog, you haven't, because this is a band that goes deep into that catalog. They're just a great act. And they play the Stoughton Opera House in 1 week from tomorrow on the 29th of March. We've got 1 minute left. I'd like to hear, I think everyone wants to hear you guys play us out. So I'm going to shut up and ask you to play us out of the last minute here. You're listening to the Friday Buzz for Elliot LeBrun and for Ankur Malhotra and for Jim Wilson. I don't have my harp with me.
Just wanted to remind people the show is on March 29th, Saturday, yes. March 29th, yes. At Stoughton Opera House.
All right. Okay. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Hard to go.
Aloha kamaaina.
Hard to go.
Sure. Sure.
I want to live. I want to give. I've been a miner for a heart of gold.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, March 21st.
Harry Truman once proclaimed, "No man should be president who doesn't understand hogs." That might explain the calamitous mess that President Trump Musk is making of our government today. Clearly, Don and Elon know nothing about four-legged farm animals, but they certainly know how to squeeze government to fatten their own two-legged breed of corporate swine. Thus, the billionaire hucksters are bulldozing agencies that serve people's real needs, while preserving those that subsidize corporate greed. For example, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a once proud agency created by Abraham Lincoln to serve tillers of the soil. But USDA today has become a bottomless feeding trough for agribusiness giants and other financial powers that till taxpayers. Our country's farm program, meant to be a safety net for hands-on dirt farmers, is now a $20 billion a year subsidy that pays zero to the vast majority of farm families. Instead, 75% of our money goes to the biggest and richest 10% of corporate fiefdoms, including billionaire speculators who never get any dirt under their fingernails. Actually, the Trump-Musk chainsaw crew is whacking some USDA programs, such as food stamps for poor families, helping school districts buy from local farmers and ranchers, and other efforts providing modest help to grassroots people and communities. But not a peep from the duo about the bales of taxpayer cash hauled every year to their own class of rich elites.